Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, and you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow, Pullman. Recovery Radio is recorded live at the Latah Recovery Center, located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery. And again, I am still Radio Johnny. I'm still a grateful recovered alcoholic, recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I have a live person in the studio with me today. His name is Todd Benson, and I'm going to welcome you, Todd.
Thanks.
Todd, why don't you tell you have a myriad of skills and experiences, and why don't you share with the audience a little bit about your history, how you got here, and then we'll go into what you do and how you do that voodoo that you do so well.
Thanks. Yeah, my name is Todd Benson. I, too, am a recovering addict, alcoholic, compulsive overeater, if you will. I work at Palouse River Counseling as a substance use disorder professional. I went to school in Pullman, graduated in 91 in a blackout. lived the life, got married, had kids, cat and dog, sprinkler system, got divorced at 30 and fell off the deep end is my story. By 37, I was homeless. And then I went to treatment, changed my life, got into recovery, and I'm coming up on 19 years. But I moved back to Pullman in 2018 to go back to school, get my master's degree. Mm-hmm. And so that's just how I got back here. I love this town. I work with the Greek system. I'm a teak from the early 90s. So I really enjoy just giving back to the community and working in this town.
Fantastic. And one of the reasons I asked to come on is because of your fantastic wealth of experience, both in recovery, but also in the counseling world. And I'm going to make an assumption here that you probably not only counsel people with, addiction issues, but probably mental health disorders as well, or
yeah.
Behavioral health disorders, I guess is more correct way of saying it.
It's interesting. In my career, right, I was, started as a drug and alcohol counselor. Then I was a chemical dependency professional. Now I'm a substance use disorder professional working in behavioral health. Just finished my master's degree in social work. So I'm working towards LICSW, which is a licensed social worker. That's a 3-year internship, basically, which is kind of funny after doing this for almost 20 years, right? I'm an intern.
Yeah.
Somebody supervises me and works on the mental health, behavioral health side, as well as, I wasn't that far away when I finished my MSW to get another master's, a master of arts in advanced addiction therapies. And so I got a bunch of new stuff with regards to how to treat in how to look at recovery from kind of the outliers of the area, spirituality, trauma, genetic, historical things, and just looking at a overall wellness, right? Nutrition, exercise, yoga, all those things. And I feel like, that's going to be my future. It's, when I first started, it was 12-step all the way, right?
Sure,
do
sure.
This or else, kind of. I went to a treatment agency in Kitsap called Kitsap Recovery Center, and it was the School of Hard Knocks, right? And
right.
You were either going to do it or get out.
Right.
And I was like, whew, it's kind of rough. But it is also, kind of how the substance use disorder industry, right, if you will, or behavior health has now combined. We're working together. There's co-occurring. We just have so much more knowledge about how to do it. And having many, many different options as well, right? Right. It's super helpful.
Because I don't think I've known anyone who's been in the AA program who didn't not have some sort of behavioral health or trauma that aided and abetted their drinking or using.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's a spiritual program of action in AA, but we find when we're dressing our spiritual self, there's certain impasses that we hit that people can struggle with. I mean, AA is a program to help the still struggling alcoholic.
Right.
You can be sober a long time and still struggle. You know, I had parental issues growing up in an alcoholic household that needed to be addressed. And even though I had been sober for 13 or 14 years, I'd never touched on them, and I couldn't understand why I wasn't making any more progress like I had, till I talked to a counselor and actually discovered there were issues that were holding me back, and I dealt with them. So, yeah, not surprising that the industry has finally caught up to with what you know, a lot of the 12-step programs have recognized for a long time.
Well, and with 12-step programs being just, not just, but being a spiritual piece, right?
Right.
Where you follow fairly strict structure to get to that spiritual piece. But even then, spirituality is just a piece of the pie.
Right.
Right? There's a whole bunch of different pieces of the pie. And there's a guy, his name is Bessel van der Kolk, and he wrote a book called The Body Keeps the Score. And he's got a YouTube TED Talk, I think it was, that, you know, he was talking about, he doesn't think people develop substance use problems without trauma. So when we think about, and it's a kind of interesting, so the statistics, you know, for a long time were 1 in 5 or 20% of the people in the population have a substance use disorder and yada, yada. And now it looks like it's almost a quarter, 1 in 4, and it's kind of growing. But along those lines, you know, mental health affects most of those people, if not all. And then if we look backwards on substance use disorder, the way they looked at it in the 70s is if you use, you can get a hook, right? And then all of a sudden, you become an addict. And maybe it's in your family or genetics or behavioral or whatever. But now they're looking at it as like, wait a second, what if substance use actually was fixing some other problem?
Right.
Maybe there was trauma or you didn't feel part of or, you know, whatever else was going on. All of a sudden, substance use was kind of a solution to something else going on. And when we look at it that way, then we say, okay, what else can we use as the solution instead of substances? And it's a whole different angle at treating the, you know, holistic person.
Right.
Yeah.
And it makes, you know, it makes perfect sense. You know, when you take your car into a shop, as an analogy, right, you know, to get an oil change, you know, a skilled mechanic will check a whole bunch of things.
Right.
You know, just to make sure everything is, like, okay for the time being, at least, you know. Your brakes are going to work because there's fluid. The radiator's going to work because there's plenty of juice in it. Sort of, you know, kind of a gross analogy, but if you're working with somebody, you know, or if you're trying to recover from a substance use problem, it makes sense to me that you look around the rest of the human being for other things that are going on. I mean, I've actually known people who have used substances to self-medicate for, I mean, diagnosable disease like schizophrenic, you know, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder. And turns out that's not a very good way to treat it.
No. But sometimes it's easier, right? I have worked with people that say, you know, bottom line is if they have auditory hallucinations, you know, I've had people tell me alcohol makes them go away. Right?
Yeah.
It's that plain and simple. However, heavy alcohol use, right, can lead to legal problems and trespasses or, you know, walking the streets and getting in trouble. So,
right. Exactly.
Yeah.
It was kind of funny you say that because I was actually told I have this essential tremor, and I been going to a neurologist to try and get to the root cause of it. And he actually told me, he said, "Do you use alcohol?" And I go, "No, I don't." And he goes, "Well, that's too bad, because a little bit of alcohol will help steady that out." And I'm like,
"Yeah, he's yay. Asking if you're in withdrawals. Right. Do you have the morning after shakes? Maybe just a shot would take the edge off, right?"
Yeah, no. Not happening.
Not anymore.
Yeah, even though I'm under doctor's orders, I'm not going there.
Sometimes when I work with people, I do ask them to put out their hands, because if I feel right, that's how I cut my teeth. So when I went to treatment, right after treatment, I was hounding them for a job, because I wanted to work there. I wanted to do something different. I was like, okay, recovery is important to me. I guess I'll make it a career.
Right.
So I was
And that happens a lot.
Yeah. No. And lived experiences have their benefits, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was asking them right away, can I get a job in detox, right? Like, and they let me work the night shift. And when I cut my teeth on that position, I learned a ton, right? But it was, sometimes I just look at somebody, ask them to put out their hands, see how bad they're shaking. You know, do you need an ambulance? Do you need to go to the ER? Do you need medication? Right. And just have a feel for that. Today, when I see that kind of stuff, it's rare, because I work an outpatient, and somebody probably drove themselves to treatment or class or group.
Right.
But it doesn't take much for me to go, "Ooh, it looks rough," right? Like, maybe we need to do something or have a talk about this.
Right. Maybe we need a slightly more aggressive intervention at this point. Yeah, because I know people who have died from seizures and withdrawal from alcohol. There's only a couple of drugs, benzos and alcohol, that can actually cause seizures bad enough to kill you in the withdrawal stage, which, one would think heroin or fentanyl would be worse, but it's actually not. I mean, it's bad. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to go through that at all. But that's something that needs to be driven home to people. If you got a pretty serious drinking problem and you want to stop, you might want to talk to your doctor about it.
Yes.
Swallow
not
your pride.
Not even might. Yeah. I've told many people, don't quit on your own.
Right.
Right? Taper off. Talk to your doctor. We used to get a medication called, it was Librium, but it was the generic chlordiazepoxide. Mm-hmm. And so once you learn how to spell that, then you're an expert.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Cool. So let's talk a little bit about trauma. Now, I know this is kind of a new area that you're moving into and being educated on. So let's just kind of do an overview, and then maybe go into a little bit about how you apply this in your practice with people.
Well, and so I did bring some notes, because I don't, so much of what I do is off the cuff.
Right.
I can talk about brain chemistry and the disease concept, 12-step stuff. I'm actually trying to get Eastern Washington University to let me come to their master's programs and teach just a short half a day, maybe teach 12-step concepts.
Right.
Because no offense to them, I don't think they have a good understanding, because they're not using the right people.
Right.
Right. So one of the things I just wanted to share was, there's three different aspects. Trauma, which is what is trauma, right? And then there's trauma treatment or trauma care, that's treating a trauma. And then there's what's known as trauma-informed care, which is the big picture of programs, organizations, and systems, right? And trauma-informed care is something that I'm very passionate about, because here is a small community. And if we really wanted to, we could put it all together so that the entire community, whether it be Moscow Pullman, Northern Idaho, right, Whitman County, right, could be looking at things from this holistic view. But I'll give you a definition. Trauma is an individual trauma results from an event, series of events, or set of circumstances that is experienced by an individual as physically or emotionally harmful and life-threatening, and has lasting adverse effects on the individual's functioning and mental, physical, social, emotional, and spiritual well-being. And that's from SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse Mental Health Service.
Right,
administration. It's the government. It's the feds.
The feds. Yeah.
Well, and here's what's interesting. Most people don't know this, but SAMHSA books are free. You can just order them from the feds. There's, I don't know what there is, 48 volumes, topic by topic by topic. Of course, I keep most of my stuff to the substance use disorder. But it's a plethora of information. Now, here's the catch. Most of it was written in 2014 when they decided we needed to, you know, have an overview of how to treat. And so it's probably due for an update.
I don't know
how often they update them.
And here at the Recovery Center, we advertise or claim that the things we do here, the peer-to-peer recovery programs that we do here are SAMHSA.
Right.
Approved.
SAMHSA approved, evidence-based.
Yeah, evidence-based. Yeah. All those buzzwords. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's important because we don't want people to think we're just winging it.
Right, exactly.
You know, that there's something behind it. So the one thing that's interesting about trauma, though, is it is truly in the eye of the beholder. Oftentimes we'll use the term capital T, little t. Most people absolutely understand big traumas, right? Car accident, death in the family, sexual abuse, you know, rape, you know, big things, right? Those are easy. They're identifiable. Anybody could know it happened and it needs to be talked about, treated or whatever, right? Because for generations or whatever, many things we just wouldn't talk about.
Right. Sure.
Certainly the alcoholism or the elephant in the room, right? We just sweep it under the carpet. And those in themselves, without discussing, become traumas.
Right.
The other ones are what I refer to as little T's. And my favorite example is imagine your parents get divorced and you're 7 years old and you think it's your fault.
Right.
And you never tell anybody. You're watching your parents do this yo-yo custody battle, weekends, drop-offs, things like that. And the whole time you think if you had been a better kid, you know, it wouldn't have happened.
Right.
And that's why communication is so big, because that can sit with a young person for a long, long time. And so I'll share my story real quick, and I hope my mom's not listening, but no, I'm just kidding. Listen, it's just my story, right? But I was 3 years clean and doing an internship to become a counselor, right? Working as a counselor. And my mentor was asking this person, when the first time they really got angry, they got the F-its, okay? I'll be careful not to say it, but it's a thing, right?
Yeah, right.
And all of a sudden I had this epiphany that I was 5 years old and my mom came home from work and she asked me if I cussed at this neighbor girl, because the neighbor said it was a blonde kid and I had long blonde hair when I was little. And she slapped me and called me a liar. And my whole world changed. And I just remember that incident. And it took, like I said, it took a while for me to remember that from that point on, I was angry. And I didn't think my parents loved me. And they couldn't protect me from my brother who was mean and all this other stuff. And started smoking cigarettes at 5, started smoking marijuana at 8, drinking at 11, and methamphetamines at 14. And even though I had all that substance use stuff and didn't feel safe at home, when I left my house, I could be anything I wanted.
Right.
So I was a great athlete, star athlete, straight A student, right? I could just morph. And then I continued to have to come home to this place that was really scary.
Right.
And I will tell you, I'm not done yet. I'm still working on it, right? Mm-hmm. That just a couple years ago, my counselor informed me that she thought, wow, your mom's house isn't safe for you. And I thought, what?
Yeah.
I'm 50 some years old and I love it there and it's waterfront property and we get to jet ski and I love my mom's house. And she goes, yeah, but 5 year old Todd doesn't. And I was like, wow. Right. So sometimes when I'm working with people, I have to let them know that the good news is you get better. The bad news is you might work on this forever.
Right.
It's just this continuous path of understanding and awareness and, you know, all the different aspects, physiological, emotional, mental, substance use, whatever.
My wife and I know somebody who's been in therapy for 40 years, pushing 50 years, And, you know, we kind of joke that it's like the Woody Allen movie Sleeper, where they wake him up 200 years later, and the doctor's telling him, yeah, you've been asleep for 200 years. And he says, my God, if I'd been seeing my counselor all this time, I'd almost be cured. You know, and so we joke about, yeah, she's almost cured. But, yeah, it's a real thing that you may be working on something your entire life, you know, not unlike alcoholism. I will always be an alcoholic. I will always have to work on it,
right?
You know, in order to, you know, remain sane concerning alcohol. Yeah, I think there's a perception out there in the general world that go to a counselor or psychiatrist and you do your 12 visits in a year and you're better.
You get fixed, right?
Right, you're fixed.
One thing that I do enjoy about substance use disorder, or I still refer to myself as a drug and alcohol counselor,
mm-hmm.
just because people understand what that means.
Right, right.
And so, I may not be a nutritionist or an exercise expert or even a financial advisor, but sometimes I joke that I stayed at a Holiday Inn because I, right. you know, all those are part of recovery. And
right.
I have a background, a vast background of mm-hmm. personal experiences and jobs and careers and education, right? That just come in handy in all aspects.
And membership in many different recovery communities,
mm-hmm.
programs, if you will. And we gain a lot of perspective on the world through that, through
yeah.
other people's experiences. And the nice thing about that is that we know they're true, because typically in the 12-step program, people are more honest
right.
about themselves and their experiences than people you would meet on the street, or necessarily even professors or, you know, whoever.
Well, and it's a,
we can
it's a style.
Trust these people
yeah.
to tell us the truth. So, you know, that's a level of education that you can't buy.
Well, and the other part of it is, and I will say this, when it originally started, right, and I wasn't there when Bill and Bob did their thing, but
right.
when it originally started, there was a stigma on there, and there's still a stigma, but
right.
but you could easily lose your job back in the day. So anonymity was super important.
Right, exactly.
However, today, right, it's more acceptable,
mm-hmm.
right? And that is changing slightly. But here's the other part that I'm not always trying to sell. No, forget it. I sell it. You know, there's the saying that it's attraction, not promotion, and that's
right.
the 12-step side. But the other side is I'm a professional, so I do try to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, straight sure. up. I will tell people. And here's the thing. We're talking about millions of people, and I don't have the exact numbers. I always just throw out numbers. It's in 187 languages in, you know, 250 countries, right?
Right.
Like, it's everywhere, 12-step programs, and it doesn't
right.
have to be one particular one. I claim to be a 12-step person, and what I encourage people to do is have a roadmap for life, and I think the 12-step program is a fantastic roadmap for life
right.
with millions of good examples,
right,
right?
Right.
Versus other things. And I know there's other programs out there, and whatever it takes, I always tell somebody, I will do anything to stay sober. I don't care if I get naked and bark at the moon,
right? Right,
whatever
right,
it
yeah.
takes. And whatever somebody wants to do, if it works, great,
mm-hmm.
right? But when I'm working with somebody new and they think they're just going to stop, I said, well, you can't just do a negative.
Right.
You kind of got to take this behavior or take this thing and replace it with something else.
Right.
And when I'm on the college, when I'm talking to college kids and I say drugs are bad, they laugh out loud.
Right. Sure.
There might be 100 kids in a room and they laugh out loud. And then I tell them, well, maybe just take Tuesday off. Right, just one day a week. Yeah. But I can do a thing where I talk about the brain chemistry and the neural pathways and building a habit in early 20s and all this stuff, and say, why not just add some other healthy neural pathways, maybe yoga, nutrition, exercise, the things that you have available that aren't under the influence.
Right.
Yeah. So let's get back to trauma. One
sure.
of the things that happens with trauma is that there's a response to the fight or flight reflex in the brain, this fear, this, life-threatening, harmful, emotional, life-threatening thing.
Right.
And what happens is, okay, so then we use this behavior, and the behavior gets into the reward cycle. And mm-hmm. so, you know, people with substance use disorders or people with addictions of any kind, right, have this mm-hmm. overactive reward system that pumps out the dopamine and the good chemicals when they do it until it becomes maladaptive, until it gets in the way of their life.
Right.
But all of that is to make the fight or flight or freeze reflex subside.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's a calming effect or what, you know, however it all works. But understanding that the brain is doing this thing over and over again. Listen, highly processed food is filled with sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they knew that this sugar would become addictive and it would light up this reward circuit and everybody would love it. And the latest stuff is, what if sugar is, I saw this YouTube thing that cancer cells love sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were saying, well, what if, and then sugar could cause the plaque in the brain that might lead to Alzheimer's. And it's like, wait a second.
Yeah.
You're talking about two of the scariest things out there could be directly related to sugar.
Right.
Yeah. And then how do you stop the mass producers of highly processed food.
Right.
Right. And the sugar.
Who are feeding the world.
Yeah. Who are feeding the world with, you know, there's foods in other countries that are banned.
Yeah.
And I was looking at this stuff and I was like, wow, that's really interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but that's, to me, that's some of that, my newest material and what I do and I work with. I had a really good friend who took a ton of medications for mental health purposes. And
mm-hmm.
one day she came up to me and she said, guess what? I quit taking my meds. And I went, wait a second.
Yeah.
Is that a good idea?
Yeah.
And she says, no, I quit eating gluten and I don't need all these meds. And I was like, what? And she goes, yeah, I figured out I was allergic to gluten. It was inflaming my whole body. It was making me crazy. It was doing all this other stuff. I changed my diet, right? Oftentimes I will tell people that we have an ailment whose solution, right, is diagnosed by Western medicine, but whose solution is Eastern medicine,
mm-hmm.
right? That's that spirituality piece.
Right.
You know, diet and exercise, easiest
things.
The most overused product for anxiety is food, and the most underutilized solution to depression is exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And most people are just kind of baffled by that, like lifestyle change.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, sugar, I mean, I can speak from experience when early on in my recovery, like in the first months and even into a couple of years, I always had a pocket full of hard candy. Right. So when I was feeling squirrely or whatever, if I couldn't, you know, talk to somebody right then, or if I was busy, you know, working or whatever, pop the hard candy, get that sugar going, and it would, you know, straight up calm me down. So, yeah. And the more sugar and the more sugar, I have a friend who's paralyzed now, and he paralyzed from the waist down. And he's older. He's 74, I think, now. And, he's gaining weight like crazy. And he was having trouble with his ankles puffing up. Well, we found out that, his wife was feeding him like she was when he was working on heavy equipment. And like Lunchables. There's so much salt in those things. It's insane. And so he was just retaining water like crazy. And so he's changing his diet and cutting way, way back on the sugar snacks, you know, the M&Ms, just that handful of stuff you don't even think about. And it's helping him. He's feeling a lot better. He's doing a lot better.
Well, most people don't understand the inflammatory side effects
mm-hmm.
of like nuts, certain nuts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sugar for sure. So one of the things I was going to bring it back to that was just looking through my paperwork for is this thing called ACEs. ACEs mm-hmm. is a list of 10 things, adverse childhood experiences.
Right.
These are things that are indicators that could lead to increased risk of physical mental health across a lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting part about how they came up with this is there was an obesity treatment center that treated hundreds of people a year, mm-hmm. right? And I'm well, I want to say thousands, but I think 5,000 sounds too high over a year. But what they did is they took all these people, and this is where ACEs was invented, and they went backwards and asked, what was your childhood like? And they came up with these 10 indicators of things where people had used food to cope.
Mm-hmm.
And became obese, and then they were, you know, and this is over a lifespan. And so now they're looking at these, like I said, ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and they're taking a look at, you know, you only need to have 4 out of 10,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's about, you know, did your parents yell? Did they get divorced? Do you have somebody in your family who's incarcerated? Was there substance use problems? Was there instability, food scarcity, right? Some basic mm-hmm. stuff, right?
Yeah.
Was your childhood unstable? And when that happens, then we look for that coping. And it's, like I said, it's food, substances, all sorts of, you know, adverse, maladaptive behaviors.
Sexual.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Over a lifetime, though, can really do wear and tear, right?
Oh, yeah.
Not just... You know, and so one of the things that I was looking at was the neurobiology of trauma and the protective function that becomes maladaptive, right? We talk about whatever we're doing. I remember being in treatment. One of the counselors talked about a fix. A fix is when we use something that doesn't actually solve the problem,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. Like you're dope sick from opioids, and so you get high again, mm-hmm. right? But it's not really solving the problem to get high.
Right.
It's just making, you know.
You're treating the symptom.
Yeah, treating the symptoms.
Right.
And so that's one of the things that in my job today, I like working backwards.
Mm-hmm.
But... Right. In order to get to that place when we can have clear cognitive thoughts and move forward with, you know, our own free will, we have to get clean first.
Right.
Right? We have to get sober. We have to get clean.
There's always that annoying little but.
That's how it works.
You might want
to
stop drinking.
Yeah. Yes. And yes, there's a nudge from the judge, and oftentimes people will be court ordered to do things. And mm-hmm. and that's the part that I like, is that, listen, I don't have to sell you forever. But if you want to, you know, get off the schneid with the courts or whatnot, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, you got this legal stuff, then just trust me for 6 months. And at the end of 6 months, I bet I could make your life better.
Right,
right. Right. I bet you can look back on it and go, wow, this isn't so bad.
Right.
And whether you stick with it or not, that's a different story.
Well, that's in AA, it's real common to have for someone to say to a newcomer, try it for a year. If you don't like it, your misery will be cheerfully refunded.
Exactly, right?
You know, so, yeah. And most people can handle it. Well, if, you know, again, if you got the nudge from the judge, you know, there's a myriad of different things. Like, say you get a DUI. Well, you're going to be under his influence for, you know, a few months at least. It's a short time. But then there are people that end up in one of Latah County, at any rate, in one of the specialty courts, mental health court, drug court, family court. Yeah. So, I mean, there are opportunities there to try something out for a little while.
Yeah, and those courts and those programs, those 2-year programs, have a lot of numerical success, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're just on paper. It looks mm-hmm. great. And here's the thing. You know, 2 years in a program and successful completion is 2 years.
Yeah.
Right? Oftentimes,
right, exactly.
If I work with somebody under 25, I ask them just to give me some time. Right? You know, your brain's not fully grown until mid-20s, later 20s, right? 25 mm-hmm. is the number I always use.
Right.
But even then, if you're 20 years old, take a year off, take a couple years off. So I'm a fourth-generation alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
I speak about my children, who are in their late 20s now, as being fifth generation. They just don't drink.
Right.
And it wasn't that I was telling them, don't ever drink. I just told them, don't start,
right?
If you have that predisposition, if you will, in your
mm-hmm.
family, if you have that genetic, you know, possibility or whatever, why would you want to, you know, challenge that or spark that or get that started?
Tempt fate
as a young person.
Right.
So a lot of the kids in college drink alcoholically. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't want to diagnose them or label them or, you know, do all that. Right. And that's the thing where back in the day, there was the University of Washington did a thing where they tracked a bunch of kids who met criteria. Mm-hmm. And then after they were 25, maybe they were in their late 20s, right? They went back and talked to them and they didn't meet criteria, mm-hmm. right? Because they just outgrew it. Right? It was college life. It's right. okay to have college life. Don't get me wrong.
Right. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't, and that's one of the things that has really changed for me in my professional life is not avoiding, but maybe not necessarily trying to jump to conclusions with young people
right.
because of their right. behavior, right? It's late adolescence, really.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. The time we make most of our major mistakes.
Correct.
And because like you said, we're not fully cooked yet.
We're not fully cooked.
Not quite done.
And the funny part about that late adolescence is it's more important to belong than safety.
Right.
And the joke I always use is, if you dare somebody to jump off the roof with an umbrella, they're going to do it.
Right, exactly.
So don't be the person who does the daring, right?
Right.
Be safe. And that's a lot of what I do with the Greek system is talk about safety.
Right.
They're doing a fantastic job with watching out for fentanyl, having Narcan on board in every house, right? Mm-hmm. Having a safety committee, having sober people at parties, whatever. Mm-hmm. They're doing a pretty good job of it.
Oh, yeah. Bouncing back to something you said earlier, when you talk about college life and drinking, I mean, there's a difference between drinking and abusing alcohol.
Yeah.
In my early days of drinking, I was like a 3 beers and done guy.
Yeah.
You know, of course, it took 30 years to, become full-blown what I considered myself to be an alcoholic or that I drank alcoholically. But 3 beers, I was good.
Yeah. No, sometimes the parties are based on getting
overconsumption.
Wasted. Yeah, wanting to black out.
Yeah.
They joke about it,
right?
And blacking out's not really a safe place to be.
No.
And I tell them that it's not really how much; it's the speed at which you're drinking.
Right.
Yeah, they really don't know how to do the math.
No.
No, one time not I at asked all. This group in a sorority, said, "Well, how many drinks can you have?" And the girl yells, 12. And I was like, "What?" Right? Like, where did you come up with that number?
If you're
right?
a 280-pound linebacker that works out every day.
Yeah, no.
Not a 90-pound size zero female.
No.
Unless she's from Alaska. No, I'm just kidding.
Listen, I was a guy who came to school to get away from my problem, and I mm-hmm. was skilled when I got here. Right. And
right.
so I was careful. But some kids are coming. They didn't really party in high school. It's a new freedom and it's a new place.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And you
folks
know.
Are not around.
Nope. And that's the other part is just, when I'm working with young people, I want them to look out for each other.
Mm-hmm.
Don't dare people and don't lace things and don't sneak
right.
hard liquor into where they weren't thinking they were drinking or whatnot.
Yeah,
Right,
protect
each other. You know, and those things in themselves, right, can be little traumatic events.
Yes.
Right? Blackouts, right. things can happen, whatever, right? Then you don't want to come to school and then have that traumatic event, right?
Right. Like, and school not be safe
yeah.
for you.
Well, and that's exactly what happens, right? Yeah. School becomes an unsafe place. Can't
right.
go to parties anymore, whatever. And definitely when I'm working with the houses. So it's kind of interesting, right? They only drink at fraternities, right? But
right.
there's sororities. Some sorority is every fraternity's best friend, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's
right.
where they go. But that's why I put it on the guys, right? Is
sure.
listen, make your house a safe place. Have a plan. Be nice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's all part of that.
For sure.
And it's an opportunity to, I don't know, you get to live your life. You get
right.
to be a college
sure.
kid.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, absolutely. And they're going to do it anyway. But
they are.
You can't unhear things.
Correct.
It might kick in. It might save a life. And that's the important part. And we're getting down to the short end of the show here.
Okay.
Is there anything a message you would like to put out? Because I know this station sparks into the university and different people listen to it. So what would you tell a broad audience in 40 sentences or less?
Well, first of all, I really appreciate the opportunity. And The one thing that I would talk about is that I think it's important. I truly believe in counseling, right? The one thing I like about being a drug and alcohol counselor is we have a time limit. We only work with people for a short period of time. You know, if they get in more trouble, they come back. Right? Mm-hmm. Mental health counseling sometimes can linger and last forever and whatnot. But my style is to give somebody some skills, put them back in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And say, go live your life, self-directed recovery, whatever it is, you know, have fun, whatever it is. And if you ever need help, you can always come back. And so I think for people, explore counseling if you want it, if you need it. You know, one of our sayings in recovery is we're only as sick as our secrets, right?
Right.
We're only as sick as we are secret, right?
Right.
Holding something inside can be part of that physical, mental, emotional trauma that can lead to physical ailments. One of the things I didn't learn about my childhood trauma, when I was 14 years old, I had back spasms. Mm-hmm. All right. My brother had been beating me daily for 8 years. Mm-hmm. But because I was an athlete, they treated my symptoms and sent me. I was a football player and went to ballet, right? Don't tell anybody.
Right. Too late.
Too late. But it wasn't until I was 45 years old that I learned about trauma that I realized, oh my goodness, my back spasms were because I was flinching.
Right.
Right. Covering I always thought up. I was going to get hit. Right? And so that caused the back problems. And so these days when I talk to somebody and they talk of physical ailments and other stuff, right? I'm starting to look like, okay, what else is going on?
Right.
And again, back to Bessel van der Kolk, the guy who wrote the book, The Body Keeps the Score, right? He says the best treatment for trauma is yoga.
Yep.
Right? It's getting in tune with your body. It's some sort of physical movement, activity, stretching, whatever. Mm-hmm. And recently, I've been coming at that. So in my recovery, I hope I have time for this. You said 40 sentences. Yes. In my recovery, I have put yoga on the table that I was going to do it once a week for a year, 50 times. But I have done that in 6 or 7 times and failed miserably. Mm-hmm. And then this year, I realized that, oh, yoga is releasing the emotional trauma that I might carry from 5-year-old Todd. And so this year, I have approached it differently. And so for the first time in my recovery of trying to do, you know, yoga once a week, I'm going to be successful because I now understand that when I do these things that it brings up emotions and that I'm healing, right? Mm-hmm. That's part of the thing. And so whatever you think might be going on, if there's mental health, if there's physical health, if there's substance abuse, right, then what is it that counseling could help you with? What could you identify? Who could you find support from? Sometimes I work with a handful of teenagers, right, like 15-year-olds. And sometimes they really just need a person that they can talk to, that they feel safe with.
Right, right. Non-judgmental, et cetera. Yeah.
And so if that's what we're doing in recovery, we're giving back to the community. We're making a safe place, right? We help support. We talk to our friends and family, whatever.
Right.
Those are really the gifts that we get from living in recovery or just living our life in a more holistic, community-minded way.
Awesome. And that's the end of your 40 sentences.
Yeah, thanks.
You nailed it. It's amazing. Now, Todd, I want to thank you for coming in and donating your time today and telling your story and talking about what you do and approach to recovery that is new in a sense, and that is I love the concept of holistic. I mean, I've felt for my whole life that, you know, everything I do affects every part of my being. You know, stop drinking for a while and see how your body heals up.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty amazing. You know, just that alone. But, you know, you tie it with the mental and, you know, the brain chemistry and all that. Yeah, it's all very important.
There's a native word, they call it capital B, beauty, right? Mm-hmm. And that's every living thing is connected.
Right, right. Yeah. I believe it. So, again, thank you very much for coming in and sharing with us. And I'm going to close with my usual. You know, if you think you have a problem with substances or behavioral health disorders, you do.
Thanks.